can't buy. You can't buy makeup stuff.
Yeah. What's the rule?
Call the meeting to order. Good morning. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, March 2nd, 2011. And a special thanks to Representative Gauthier for the treats that we have.
Thank you very much. My pleasure, Mr. Chairman.
We will record that in the minutes as a special treat from our new member. We have the Revenue Department overview, and then we have a bill coming up before us. And we do have a quorum, and so you have the minutes before you from our meeting from Monday. Would someone move those minutes? Representative Banyan moves the minutes of Monday, February 28th. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Commissioner Salamone, please come forward. And oh, I'm sorry. We have a second set of minutes from yesterday. Representative Anderson moves the minutes from yesterday, March 1st. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor of the minutes of March 1st, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Those minutes are approved. Welcome, Commissioner Salamone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to come back to the committee and share additional information that we haven't provided the last time we were here. I think the focus here is on our operating budget. We have, as usual, PowerPoint slides. Seems like we can rarely get along without them. So hopefully you can follow the presentation on the monitors. Much of what I'll present today may be redundant in that we did do an overview of the department, and some of it you'll hear again, but we'll try not to be too repetitive. The mission of the department, I think by now you all understand our role is to collect revenues. Our mission is to make the revenue system work for the state of Minnesota, and that involves a whole bunch of activities that we do to make sure that taxpayers are prepared to meet their obligations, because we essentially have a voluntary tax system for the most part. It's a very, very small percentage of taxpayers who require extra attention with regard to their liabilities. The vision is that every taxpayer pays the right amount, no more, no less, and obviously the more voluntary that is, the better. We often talk about our compliance cycle. I mentioned that last time, that it's not just a matter of tracking down taxpayers and collecting money. It's about educating taxpayers, informing them about their obligations to file and the methods in which they are able to file. We make recommendations to the legislature for tax policy changes, both for the sake of better tax policy, but as well for the sake of better tax administration. Obviously, we're in the business of auditing and collecting revenues. That's a major activity. And for those few taxpayers who need a little extra encouragement to pay their taxes, we do have the enforcement branch of the agency, which has gotten a lot of attention in recent months. So if you look at the bottom of the page 2 or the slide that says FY 12-13 base budget, those are the numbers that include the governor's recommendations. One notable element of that chart is that 97% of our revenues are general revenues, general fund revenues. We are very light in the area of special funds. But you can see the special funds there, the healthcare access fund, about 1.3% of our revenues, the highway user tax fund, 1.6% of our revenues, and the environmental fund, 0.1% of our revenues. So we're very light on the on special revenues. You'll forgive me, members, for coughing and sneezing here. I've been battling a cold. I wonder why that is.
You have a lot of company on that.
I think so. So the Our base budget, including the governor's recs, is $271,801,000, and that's for the biennium. On the next slide, we see that the governor has made two recommendations with regard to the budget of the Department of Revenue. First, he's recommending a roughly $4.4 million reduction, biennial reduction in our operating budget. That's roughly slightly higher than a little over 5% of our support portion of our department. We often talk about the two halves of the department, or the two partitions of the department. One is direct compliance activity, and the other is compliance support, the backroom functions that make that facilitate the auditing and collecting. So we have these two areas of the department that are very distinct, and when we get budget reductions, we apply them to and limit them to the support area of the department in order to protect the revenue flow. The direct compliance activities yield revenues very directly, as opposed to the backroom functions of HR and training and so on. Obviously, the support is not unrelated to the direct compliance activity. So the governor's recommended that a reduction of $4.368 million. He's also recommending another tax compliance initiative that would generate $43.5 million gross at a cost of $11.37 million for a net revenue increase of $32.13 million. So that is the governor's recommendation for a compliance initiative to bring in that additional revenue. I believe the members have change item pages for those two items.
Commissioner, could you explain a little bit more about the numbers here? The the budget reduction of $4.368 million, that is irrespective of the additional appropriation of $11.37 million? And so the net reduction would be 4.368 minus the 11.37?
Mr. Chair, there are two separate items here. One is our operating budget reduction, and that is roughly 5% of the support portion of our department. And then in addition to that, as a totally separate item, the governor is coming in with a compliance initiative whereby we will get an appropriation from the governor's recommendation is an appropriation of $11.37 million in order to raise 43.5. That's a rate of return of roughly 4-1. So we're getting resources to raise more revenues, and the relationship is a 4-1 roughly on that. So the net, and when you net out the expenditure to get the gross revenues, the net would be roughly $32 million.
And where does the $11.37 million appropriation show up then?
I think that's in our, would that wind up in our case budget?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name's Dan Ostick. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Revenue. I think what you're getting at is it would be a net increase to the Department of Revenue of roughly $7 million. The $11.7 million, of course, would go on the compliance side of our agency, and the reduction of 4.368 would be a reduction to the compliance support type of areas.
Okay. You may Representative Anderson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Salamone. The tax compliant initiative that you're asking more money for, is that for more auditors to go out and audit businesses in the state of Minnesota and further drive them out of this state?
Commissioner?
We do dedicate the funds for initiatives, compliance initiatives, to largely auditors and collectors. You're right. That's essentially how we use that money. In fact, I think it's expected that we're going to use that money that way. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we, by necessity, have to be more aggressive. Obviously, there are going to be maybe more auditors and collectors in the field. and obviously we have a goal to reach in terms of revenue. And we understand the concerns that have been raised in the past about our degree of aggressiveness, and you know where do you draw the line and so on. And we know we have more work to do in terms of training our auditors and collectors in terms of the soft skills of tax collection as opposed to the hard technical aspects of the job. We talk a lot about that now in the department, and we're very concerned, and we recognize the concerns you all have about that.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salamone, I not only get complaints from businesses, but I get complaints from state agencies in the way that your office and the tax auditing division handle people and the consumer. I've always been taught in business that the customers is the company, and that the customer, if you want to keep them, you treat them right. I'm hearing from state agencies. Heard it in Ag Policy Committee just the other day, and hear it from my several businesses that your auditors come in and they have no real, what would you say, demeanor, very good demeanor with the people that they deal with, and I'm just kind of appalled by the remarks I get back, and I'm just wondering what kind of training you do, if it's minimal, or if there's any type of thing to enhance the way you treat the customer, especially even your own state agency people that are here in the state area. So my concern is the way that you deal with and your agency deals with the customer out there supposedly going after more revenue, which is great. I mean, that's part of your command underneath the statute. But the way you handle people is not very respectful.
Commissioner, you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm actually surprised to hear that with regard to the other agencies. We've had a lot of wonderful collaborations with our sister agencies, and I have not heard directly complaints from them. Now, you do know, I think, that we have statutory authority to collect other agency debt, and I'm assuming we do that with professionalism and so on. I have not heard any complaints, and certainly we'll look into that. And if I don't know if Terry is here, if you have any comments, Terry. Terry's our Assistant Commissioner for Income Taxes.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Terry Steenbluck, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes. And in response to the feedback that you've provided, we've heard that as well throughout the course of this session and from others, other groups that we've been interacting with. And we have committed to making some changes, and I know the Commissioner is going to talk about those in a little bit, but more specifically, some of the changes that we are making. We're currently reviewing all the training that is provided to the auditors and the collectors. We're currently doing a needs assessment on, we're trying to teach them the soft skills and how to interact with the customers and what's appropriate behavior. So we are going to be increasing our training in that area. One of the other things that we're working on implementing as well is a quality assurance program. So right now, for example, we've got some of the audit supervisors calling some of the businesses when they've been out in the field and doing the audits, asking, you know, how did the audit go? How long was the person there? How did they interact with you? Do you have suggestions or feedback as to how we could make that process better? Were you able to discuss the timelines and the information so that we can look at that as well and incorporate that into the performance of the auditors and the collectors?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, my constituent business in my area got a letter back from your department, one of your auditors, and they said in the statement, the letter written to you, to her and her business, that the business was very uncooperative, that they did not want to help, and they did not give any suggestions as to helping them in doing their audit. And when I went and talked to them and sat down with them, I sat down with the boss, the husband and wife who owned the business, and the managers of the store, and they said when the auditor came in, we sat there for the whole time that they were there, and they never asked one question about what or about anything about on the statements or any of the paperwork that they went through. They asked for questions, and they were told, we're okay. And yet, I come from an agricultural background. This particular area is agriculture. You sell a ton of hay to a farmer, and you get charged tax for it. And the auditor says, you prove that it's not taxable. And I'm going into the ag division and going into the background. And the basically, the kind of attitude that you get from the auditor to say, you prove it, it just doesn't set well with my people. And I'm going, they're saying, where do you get these people from? So I'm very disturbed by the fact that not only did they give me that type of, I mean, these are three individual stores, managers who come in and just were, and then I talk to agency people and I go, yeah, we get the same thing from the Department of Revenue. They're just very uncooperative. They're a bunch of climbers. All they're doing is looking for number one and they want to get to the top. So I'm just disturbed that we pay good money to state employees and the attitude that they give to the people out there who pay their bills, who pay the taxes, and then pay their salaries, basically, the Department of Revenues and other state agencies, and they get slapped in the face with some kind of a letter back. It's just not very kosher, and I don't like it.
Either of you wish to respond?
Mr. Chair,
Steenblatt.
Representative. I need to apologize. I guess that would be my primary response, is to apologize if that's the perception that's out there and if we are doing some of those things. On a personal note, I do take customer service very seriously, and I would welcome, if you have some examples, I would welcome you sharing those with me, and I would be happy to follow up with those taxpayers and make sure that we address the issues. That would help us, too, as well, from a training standpoint. If we could get some specific feedback, then we will make sure we incorporate that and make sure that we provide feedback to the auditors that are demonstrating those behaviors.
Members, I think as we hear particular concerns out there among our constituents, we ought to pass that on to the department and ask them to look into it. I think this is a good reminder of the importance of our forwarding that information so that you can address it. Representative Banyan. I'm sorry, Representative Benson was next.
Well, that's a good, great mistake. I'd like to be compared to my colleague. I have a question about page 8, the example that you gave in terms of the additional 81 employees. So just so I have an understanding of the ongoing relationship between the expenditures and the revenue. It's a 4-to-1, as you explained. And as I look at it, in FY12, the expenditures is $3,800,000 with the revenues of expected revenues of 14, and then in 13, second year of the biennium, that's when we pick up the remaining 43. But going out the 75-30, that'd be the combination of apparently having hired all 81 of those employees and having them in the field. So we are still looking at a 4-to-1. At 77.5 mil and 29, do we see that continues? I'm always worried about we're always continuing to add employees, but do we really get the expected revenue return, or is there a diminishing return on that on those expenditures? So you're confident that from there on out, those 81 brand new employees are always going to generate that same level of return?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah. That is correct. The second year, for instance, the appropriation, I believe it's 7.53, mm-hmm. Would go into the base for the ongoing years, and the revenue, I believe it's roughly 29 million, would go into our base target for the outgoing years. That okay. is correct. And we have, in previous initiatives, kept up with the base target for revenue. So that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the compliment, Representative Benson. And I'll take the chair's advice, and I have similar stories, Representative Anderson. I'll just send them to you offline. If I could get your business card later, that'd be great, and we can just move on to save a little time here. When you visited us last time, I think one of the things we talked about was your noncompliance report and audit. And I went and pulled that back up in preparation for visiting with you again today. And I see, I'm looking at page 6 of that. I don't know that you brought it. I don't know that anyone asked you to. I certainly did not. But I see listings of the number of people you found noncompliant. What I don't see in this report is how many people you actually, actually audited. How many people did you observe relative to the number of people that you actually found out of compliance? So I would like to know what that rate is, because I have a follow up to that. But first of all, do you happen to know those numbers,
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner?
We don't have those numbers. I think we can put those together. I'd have to look into that. I understand what you're asking.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, what I would like is actually, if we could get that over time, that might give us a better feel for this return on investment. Mr. Cummings, and welcome back, sir. Mr. Cummings sent a nice chart to us yesterday by email of a representation of this return on investment. You know, how many dollars of revenue you target per dollar that you send out, and I wonder if we're actually including somehow what's going on there, because here's the follow up. And I asked you this last time, Commissioner, and maybe you've got a different answer. Having time to think about it, I always think of new stuff after I leave a meeting. What about the cost to the people who sat down and talked to the auditor? How do we know what that cost is, and how do we get to that? Okay, this is truly an opportunity cost story. What foregone opportunities? What foregone sales? What foregone profits were sacrificed in the process of dealing with audits? This is lost in this whole discussion for me, and I think the increased amount of complaints that Representative Anderson, I'm hearing, and other people is this frustration that I'm being kept from doing things that are able to produce more sales, more jobs, more revenue, and actually more revenue for us as well. And I'm really curious if somehow we can have that kind of information as we try to figure out whether or not we want to spend more money on compliance.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Banyan, I hear you loud and clear, and I totally understand what you're asking about. Our job is to administer the tax system. There's a public cost to that, which you see in the budget numbers, and there's a private cost to that, which are the taxpayers who we deal with. And we have to somehow find the balance there. And make sure, and not so much balance, but making sure that the cost on taxpayers is as minimal as we could make it, mm-hmm. and still do our responsibility collecting taxes. And that's probably going to require a lot of soul searching and sort of thinking about strategies to do that. One good thing that Terry mentioned was, and we're doing this now routinely, is giving taxpayers a little survey card, and they can sort of give us some feedback on how the audit went. And I don't know if on that card there is this question that says how much time was involved in this audit, because that's probably the biggest cost.
That would be good to know.
And the foregone revenues. So they'll give us a little project there to work on for a while. We'll get back.
Thank you. And my last question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things this is kind of related, but going maybe in a different direction. One of the things I see is as we add more people, we're assuming that they're going to collect new revenue, but we already have compliance people that have already identified non-compliant individuals. Presumably in the education process, those people now will become compliant and stay compliant, right? So I'm trying to figure out why those auditors aren't hunting down. God, that's a bad word. But how come those people are not finding additional non-compliant individuals, if maybe the way to get at that is, what's the recidivism rate? How many times do you have to audit somebody twice and catch them out of compliance two times or more?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair,
that was a bad question. I apologize,
Representative. I don't have that data, but that may be something we can.
You know what I'm sorry. I'm just trying to clarify what I'm trying to say here. You have people out doing a search. Once a person's in compliance, that revenue should keep coming from them. So those auditors should now be able to go out and find additional new revenues. But now you're adding additional auditors on top of that. It almost feels like the compliance rate should be accelerating, not tailing off. Do you know what I mean? And so I'm trying to really get at what is it true that the people who are not audited go back to their old non-compliant ways, whether it be out of ignorance or out of malice?
Mr. Commissioner, Representative Banyan, I think it's a mixture of both. I don't think we can assume that once a taxpayer is brought into compliance that we can just ignore them and sort of take them off of our audit schedule, if you will. I think it's a question of monitoring that and seeing that taxpayers stay in compliance. It's one thing to get them in. It's another to keep them in compliant mode with various, information, for example, is important in that regard. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I made my point. We'll just have to communicate privately on some of this.
I'd like to do that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can... I won't comment on anything else except ask maybe a couple of questions to help me quantify. Asking for more resources, I think it's important to know where you are and what your goals are and what your ultimate... revenue projections want to be. How many of the businesses are we auditing now? And in these added bodies, where are we going? Are we going to do sales and use tax audits? Are we going to do annual returns on businesses? Are we going to do personal income taxes? Do you have a breakdown of that? And then if you're going to add more people, we're obviously going to audit a greater percentages of the tax return world. And do you have some data on that that would help me get a better feeling?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, a Representative, we go through it. When we get a request from the legislature or the governor to consider a new compliance initiative, we pull our various divisions. In fact, Dan Ostick, our financial services director, immediately polls our division directors, and ask the question, what could you do to help raise more revenue? And what are you comfortable with as a target? So we make sure our own division directors are comfortable with what they think they can do in the way of a contribution toward the overall compliance goal. And we go through the entire agency that way. Obviously, we don't pull the support divisions, but the online tax divisions are pulled.
Mr. Chair, Representative,
Mr. Osby?
That's exactly right. We do have a breakdown of where the appropriations go as far as corporate tax, sales tax, individual tax, everything like that. So I could share that with you. Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
Representative Stensrud,
thank you. So it would be. I'd like some real hard numbers. Like, in last year, we did this percentage of individual returns. We did. Because when I speak with some of the business owners in my community, I mean, I can come up with, a dozen who feel like 100% of the businesses are getting the sales and use tax audit. And I think, well, it's probably not 100%, but how would I know? So, and if we're going to expect increased collections in that area, well, if we're doing 95% audits, well, we're not going to get this kind of return with just an additional 5%. So I think those real numbers would give us a better comfort level in terms of how we allocate some of the resource dollars.
We can provide those numbers. Beautiful. Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good discussion here, and I think a really relevant point, especially as we consider the governor's request for another $43.5 million in compliance revenue. If I could, Commissioner, on page 24 and 25, I just want to make sure I have all the numbers straight here. The table, I'm talking about your budget document, the narratives pages. On page 24, there's a table that shows $41.5 million revenue target in 2010 and 11. And I'll just make a statement, and you can confirm that I'm right or not. That was from our budget solution for the two-year biennium. And then there's another $26.9 million from 2011. I assume that was the final negotiated settlement at the end of session last year. So there was a grand total of $68.4 million in new compliance revenue that the legislature asked you to produce. Is that accurate? Mm-hmm.
Commissioner, or Mr. Osti?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could, just a couple of quick other verifying questions, too. So when you talk about rolling the first year of the biennium into the next year's kind of standard base, so you would have rolled half of 41.5, so roughly $20 million into the base this year. Is that right? You wouldn't have factored that 26.9 from the settlement last year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, it's close to half, correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then do you do the same thing? I know we had an FTE bump to accomplish that new revenue, compliance revenue. Do you roll half of the appropriation for the people into the next year's base, or do 100% of the people that were added for that compliance revenue, does 100% of that get rolled into next year's base?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, yes, it rolls in the next year. So
100% of the 100%, people.
100%, correct.
Representative Downey?
So, members, I think we get a little bit of a picture of this diminishing returns and why we see the increase in compliance people. We only build half of that revenue, but all of the people stay there. And I think Representative Stenzud and others, your questions are really good ones about where that goes. And then if I could, Mr. Chair, on page 25, it shows that your collections to date, and I think in the narrative, you're somewhere north of $20 million against that target of $68 million. And just to confirm that that's accurate, that I'm portraying that correctly.
Mr. Osti?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, let me backtrack a little. You said half. I believe it's basically two-thirds. If you look at the initiative in front of you, the first year is roughly 3.8. The second year is 7.5. Okay, so it's really two-thirds, not half.
Gotcha.
Okay. For instance, in this initiative, 40 people in the first year come on board, and then an additional 41 come in the second year. So that is not why you're having diminishing returns.
Okay.
It's basically, you know, you get your low-hanging fruit first, and then it keeps on going down. So I would say, no, that's not correct.
But, Mr. Chair, to the graph on page 25, then, just to confirm that we're about not even a third of the way there yet, I guess, in terms of our actual to budgeted compliance.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I'm not sure on what page you're referring to.
On page 25 of your
is it the compliance
of your budget narrative, you show a graph that has the actual at about $20 million against the target of $68 million. Okay. The actual versus target graph. I can hand it to you if you'd like.
That'd be great.
Mr. Osti?
This has been a long time. Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, this chart is somewhat old. I think right now in this initiative, we are above target, actually, for the 41.5 that's supposed to be collected. We're above target, and for the 26.8, we're right on target to meet the 26.8. So the 41.5, I think we will surpass that. In fact, I know we will surpass that. And the 26.8 will come really close to that. I hope that answers your question. Because this was as 7/31/10, the
okay,
chart.
So that's okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To this line of questioning, which picks up on questions that we had brought up before, obviously we care about compliance. We want compliance. People pay, as you say in your mission, the right amount, no more, no less. And your individual numbers going from year to year of what your increase in compliance has been able to yield, that's helpful information. To me, what I'm trying to get my arms around is what percent of that those investments are really carrying forward year after year. I understand for any given year, any given biennium, your numbers bear fruit. But when we keep adding and adding and adding, what percent are paying dividends going forward? Can you put kind of a percentage on that of past investments? Are they continuing to yield or provide dividends?
Great question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I believe some of you got a chart about how this rolls into the base and how much revenue. Since 2001, just to give you a broad view of this, since 2001, $57.3 million has been included in our base for compliance initiatives on an ongoing basis per year added. So, and on an ongoing basis for revenue, that's $273 million. Does that answer your question? So let me give you an example. I'm just going to throw out numbers. But for instance, in 2001, I want to say roughly our budget was $85.3 million in 2001. Mm-hmm. Now it is roughly 136 or whatever the number was. So that compliance has been added to that base. Mm-hmm. So it's roughly $57 million in compliance initiatives alone. There's been budget reductions, of course, and other things from tax bills, things like that. But on a whole, $57 million per year has been added. So that adds $273 million per year in base target revenues as well. For instance, we collected $616 million last year, and I think at an expenditure of roughly $125 to $130 million, somewhere in that range.
What's the total amount of increased compliance revenue that we've had since this 2004, the first year of the compliance? What's the total amount of investment that we've made?
On an ongoing basis, like I said, $57 million into the base and added $273 million on an ongoing basis per year. That's, I guess, the best way to explain it.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee who haven't been on it before, just wait till you get to try and go to your caucus and set targets. And you discover that although this committee has one of the smallest bases of any of the financial divisions, it also has the people that it deals with have the least political support of any. And so you just, unless your caucus is much more foresighted than ours ever was, you are going to be given, out of bounds targets. And at the end, we always ended up meeting them with one part by compliance. And one of the things, compliance by its very definition, you can go back to the Greek definition background of the word, is not a pleasant thing. And so what happens is that people who don't voluntarily comply get into nasty contacts. So, and if you notice, if you look on page 25 at the graphs, one of the reasons, and we've always had, revenue has always appeared before us, so I'm going back through all these little graphs, and they've always said, it's going to be very difficult, we can't possibly do it, but then when we came to the end of giving them some program for data analysis, something that they really wanted, or not doing it, they always agreed. And if you look at the graph on page 25, one of the things you'll see is that their actual compliance always exceeded their target. So, you know, you can do all you want about talking about being nicer and more gentler and so forth, but lots of luck in meeting your target. At least, Mr. Chairman, it's your responsibility and not mine.
Thanks for the reminder, Representative. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, approximately how many taxpayers or taxpayer units, I guess, if we had businesses and whatnot, do we have in Minnesota?
In terms of individual income taxes, yes. It's about 2.7 million.
Okay, and what about businesses?
Don't have a business number. $400,000, $500,000.
Okay, so we're talking about $3 million. How many audits do you do a year?
Commissioner, Mr. Osteek?
$140,000.
Okay.
Roughly. Mr. Chair, I assume that when you come and do an audit, people aren't yelling, hooray, the tax man's here. I mean, by its very nature, it's kind of adversarial. It's kind of, you know, people I know that have been audited feel like they've been caught. I think that's just a natural instinct. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's the basis for it?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sure that's all part of the anxiety of a pending audit. Taxpayer may be have anxiety about not having the records in proper order. There's just a lot of factors, I guess, that would make it a less than, you know, comfortable experience. And we do everything we can, I'm sure. I hope we do. Our auditors and collectors try to put them at ease and have a good experience under the circumstances. But it's by nature somewhat stressful. Mm-hmm. I haven't been through one myself, and I hope never have to go through one. But I can imagine that would be pretty stressful.
Okay.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are these audits selected randomly, or is there a method to it, and are they statewide?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, I think Terry, our income tax director, might have more to say on this, but I would suspect it's not a random thing. I mean, we're trying to get much more targeted in who we audit so that we're not wasting resources and going down dead ends and blind alleys and so on.
Okay.
So I think it's more than simply a random event, and Terry might give us a little more detail on that.
Mr. Chair, then just anecdotally, since I don't get a lot of complaints about tax audits, I guess people in northern Minnesota pay their taxes better than people in other parts of the state. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just want to close in saying to you that, you know, I don't envy your job and your position, because you're, you know, it's like you're a revenuer, as my grandpa would say, and nobody likes revenuers. But I just want to say thank you for your service, and when we look at what the return is in compliance, I'm happy with it, so thank you very much.
Representative Benson, and then we will want to let the commissioner finish the presentation. And sorry that all the questions, but that's where the interest lies. So, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too believe that you have a really difficult job. So our questions really are more around how much is enough, and, you know, looking at state budgets and the like, where do you fit into that? But has anybody ever tried to develop an algorithm based on past experiences regarding, you know, your experience of gaining more taxes through audits? How much money's out there that's not being collected? I mean, it's
hard. Mr. Chair, Commissioner? Representative, we've had two special studies commissioned. We had commissioned two studies, one in the individual income tax and the other in the area of the individual, the sales and use tax. And both of those studies, I think the income tax, I'm trying to remember the numbers, we asked the contractors to come up with a expected amount of revenue that we should expect to collect given the status of the economy and so on. And we had a report on the income tax, which I think came in at about $800 or $900 million, a gap between what we think we should be getting and what we're actually getting. And then I think the sales tax was a smaller number, in the neighborhood of $500 and so million. So we have done those studies, and those studies actually provided the initial impetus to doing compliance initiatives. There's never been a time when the Department of Revenue went to the legislature or went to a governor and said, we would like to do a compliance initiative. It was always something that was given to us, and I think it was primarily because of those tax gap studies, we call them, and that was sort of how this all started.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm, this is a statement. You don't have to answer the question because I'm trying to hurry up for the chairman too. But so we could extrapolate from there that if we added, if we look at that 4-to-1 number, if we added a couple hundred more, maybe we would get to that full amount. But I'm also very sensitive, and I haven't asked the question to what Representative Banyan got to earlier, and that is, based on experience, you would think that after you've did person, you should be able to move on. So I'm not sure adding additional people constantly is the best. That's not a question. I want to get to the other one. How do we know that the base increase is just not a product of a sustained increase or an increase in just overall economic activity? I mean, that $29 million that we're going to collect, and we're adding it in as a base because we do these compliant audits. How do we know that those increases aren't due to something else?
Mr. Ostig?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, we track it. We track revenues, involuntary and voluntary revenues. So we know the base revenues that I referred to is involuntary revenues where we go out and audit and collect. Keep in mind, I want to say one more thing about the initiatives. Keep in mind that roughly 50% of the initiatives is collectors. It's people that owe money that just have not paid, and we have to go out and collect for them. So it's not all auditors, just so everybody knows that.
Thank you.
Representative Banyan?
I promise this will take 30 seconds. I wanted to point out and just make have them verify the two studies you mentioned about the amount of tax that has not been collected you had done. When were they done?
Commissioner?
1999 and 2001, I'm told.
Okay, so we have no measure of how much of that gap's been closed by your activities.
Correct. We would only be able to infer that.
That's all I need. Thanks.
Good question. Commissioner, sorry for the interruption, but those are important questions, so you may proceed.
I actually appreciate the questions and the dialogue. I think we, on my presentation, we're on a slide where you see two pie charts, just to remind you that we, in a sense, almost have two agencies within one. We have the direct compliance, and we've been talking about that, the auditors and the collectors, and they're on the front line, if you will, of tax administration. If you look at the chart in 2000-2001 biennium, 48% of our activities were direct compliance, and now in the current 12-13 biennium, the direct compliance proportion is 69%. So we went from 48% to 69%, and I think that's partly what we're seeing a reflection of that in some of the questions here. Putting on a little more pressure in that area. It's been a challenge for us to keep the support end of the house in some reasonable proportion to the frontline activities. That has been shrink from 52% to 31%. Some of that's appropriate for, you know, we've had much more technology and we don't need as many people as we did in the past in the support functions. So that's been an interesting and important thing to recognize in our budget. And when we get budget cuts, we limit those to that support area of the agency. As you know, we talked, I think last time when we did an overview, we talked a lot about our integrated tax system. We are closing in on the end of that project and beginning to have conversations about decommissioning a number of legacy systems that we've had and depended on over the years to administer the tax system. I think there's not a lot more to say about the tax integrated tax system other than that we are on the cusp of being able to provide, when this project is done, a much higher level of service to taxpayers. When a taxpayer calls about their account, we can pull down every piece of correspondence we've had with that taxpayer on a video screen and know what they're referring to and have a good conversation with the taxpayer and know that the data that we're getting from the system is accurate, or is at least as accurate as it can possibly be. Before this new system, we had to go through in and out of roughly 142 different applications. Most of them were jerry-rigged on the quick by our staff, who we never did get a significant amount of appropriations for this kind of activity. So we had to sort of have all these disconnected systems, and it was very difficult to give taxpayers uniform information and good and prompt service. And so we are now going to be able to do that very soon. We're just finishing up this project. At the end of the project, there's one last phase that we call Taxpayer Access Point. It will allow taxpayers to interact with us just as we do with our banks in terms of checking our account to see, you know, if a delinquent tax has been resolved or whatever the issue may be. So it'll be very modern in terms of tax administration, and I think I mentioned the last time I was here that this is a off-the-shelf CAN software program. It's provided by a company called Fast Enterprises. And many of those folks are former tax administrators who built the system. Whenever they make an upgrade for some state, and they have, I think, 13 to 15 states, when they make an upgrade, we automatically get the benefit of that upgrade. They basically provide it whenever they do upgrades with other clients. So that's going to save us a lot of money in the long run and provide much more service to taxpayers. And hopefully you'll all hear wonderful things about the Department of Revenue when that's done. There's a chart on the screen that should be a multicolored matrix. I don't know if it's coming. There it is. Every color represents a different process and a different system. And can you imagine trying to manage that? And that's what we were dealing with before we engaged the contract on the integrated tax system. In contrast, if you flip another couple slides further, you'll see a slide that's what it looks like today. That's the integrated tax system. We got rid of all the colors and the different systems and applications, and so we're going to have a much better system overall. In terms of the project, I don't know that it's terribly significant for you to know that there were four distinct rollouts, and we are in the final phase of the last rollout, and looking forward to providing that better service. And I'll have to say that, I should say that this project, again, has been on time and on budget, and it's fully funded. You don't have to find any more money for us for the integrated tax system, and we appreciate the money that was appropriated.
Well, I guess.
Representative Kahn?
And just a further reminder, this came from increased compliance efforts.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I had forgotten that.
I don't.
I've skipped over a few slides, and I think we can go to the one that is called Department Successes. I just mentioned the integrated tax system, and that's certainly one that we're very proud of and happy the way it's turned out. We are also very proud of the fact that we are, according to the IRS, a leading state in electronic filing. Electronic filing brings just all kinds of wonderful things to the taxpayer. They can file their tax returns in their pajamas, and they don't have to go down and talk to somebody. They get their refunds very quickly. We have had refunds in as few days as three or four, depending on what's going on in the system. That can vary. So taxpayers, we get a lot of positive feedback on those quick refunds. We partner with other state agencies. We have done a lot of work. We are really a center of excellence in the state of Minnesota for payment processing and data entry. And we have times during the year where we have slack time and we don't have enough work to do in those areas. So we've partnered with other agencies to do data entry work for them. We've worked for DEED. We've done some work with DNR, the University of Minnesota, and the Department of Public Safety. So we're very open to collaborating with other agencies on these kinds of things that we can do better than most other agencies can. One of our new projects that we are just completing a pilot on is a electronic certificate of real estate value. We've been working with Dakota County to totally electrify the transmission of these property tax statements, and starting with the certificate of real estate value. And you know there's a lot of documents associated with real estate transactions, and there's a lot of that 87 counties, and multiply that by the number of documents each county would have for a given real estate transaction. You can imagine the efficiency that we'll gain when we're able to send that paper back and forth electronically. So we're really happy. I sat through a pilot demonstration just a few days ago, and hopefully we'll get that up and running and eventually see it across the state. That'll be wonderful. We also accept what we call electronic check presentment. You're all familiar with Check 21 or ACH. There are all kinds of things that we can do to be more efficient. I think some of you are aware of the fact that we voluntarily entered into an interagency agreement with the Office of Administrative Hearings. We had surplus space in our agency, in our building, the Stassen building at that time. And we were always interested in lowering our rent. We were paying rent on space we weren't using. We approached OAH and agreed to share space with them. And not only did we begin sharing our space, we shared services. We provide OAH financial services. Dan does some of their work for them. We share front desk services. We share physical security, the badging, and so on. So it's been a wonderful collaboration, and money has been saved. I haven't quantified it, but it's definitely a win-win for us. We do a lot of video conferencing to keep our travel costs down. We are very aggressive in telecommuting. We've written probably one of the best, telecommuting contracts that we have with our employees. We are also have been engaged in data warehousing and data mining. I think when Greg Cheetah, our IT person, was up here last time, he was talking about the work we had done with the University of Minnesota, really cutting-edge stuff. We are very open to doing more of that kind of work. It's important to us. So that's something that we will be continue to work on. We'll continue to be working on. On the next page on my slide, I mentioned the taxpayer access point. I want to move on to another item called Extranet. We want to be able to share confidential information across the Internet and know that it's very safe and secure, and that's another thing that we're working on. I think those are the main areas in terms of our successes and enhancements. I'll also mention just recently we've engaged a process, a lean process, if you're familiar with that, LEAN process, with regard to the management of return mail. We've had large volumes of return mail that we need to find ways to reduce that and to manage that better. And that is a nearly completed, I think there's a celebration coming up at the end of the lean project to recognize the work that our employees did on that. And I think that's pretty much it. We've done a lot of work also in the area of training our employees. We had to train every year. We have to train 1,200 employees in various financial code of conduct, and that's a pretty daunting task every year. We've in terms of challenges, we're concerned about the loss of institutional knowledge, but again, every agency is probably worried about that right now. There is a growing stress on the compliance support area of the department. I mentioned that. Our workforce is very diverse, and we think that's both a challenge and a blessing. We have a language line when taxpayers call in and they don't speak English. We can provide assistance for them. In fiscal 10, we've had 47,000 minutes of time on that landline, on that language line. So we're doing what we can to make sure that taxpayers are being served and getting what they need from us. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I'll stand for questions.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, just a question about the language line. Is that something that's provided through OET and is available to all departments?
Yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Representative, it is an OET service that we take advantage of.
Representative Kahn.
An emphasis, though, that it's just not you that get to use it, but anybody could use it, including legislators, I would guess.
I would assume that it's open to all agencies.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, are there any matters in litigation right now that we should know about where we potentially have either a big upside or a big downside in tax court or in the Supreme Court?
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I'm not aware of a really big one. At any point in time, there's usually some litigation floating around. But in terms of big ones that might have huge budget implications, I'm not aware of any.
Representative Simon, good question.
Yeah, well, we're looking for anything we can get here, in terms of money. One other question, just about the timeline. I think in response to Representative Banyan's question, you said that the last two studies about the so-called gap were 1999 and 2001. I seem to remember one in and around 2006, and maybe you didn't do it, maybe it was someone else who did it, and the reason I remember it, someone in my own political party running for governor who, at the time, and I remember thinking this was kind of silly, but this candidate was banking on $1 billion a year and made a big deal about the fact that if this person was elected governor, he'd spend that money on higher education. He was banking $1 billion, and he was waving around this study. Now, maybe it was an old study by the time this person was waving it around. But this person was banking the whole billion when all of us know that to get the billion, you'd probably have to spend $300 million or $400 million to get the billion, and you'd net maybe $600 or $700 million. And I remember, frankly, rolling my eyes a bit. But I remember that in the 2006 campaign. Am I wrong about the timeline, or was it just an old study that this candidate was waving around?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I'm reminded that it may have been an update of the early income tax gap study. It was done in 2001.
Yes, sir.
So it might have been an update. There was one update, so that's probably what we were talking about.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, and your colleagues. Appreciate your being here today, and thank you for all the tough work you have to do for Minnesota.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Next, we will take up the House File 174, Representative Pepin. Welcome, Representative Pepin, and I will move House File 174. Our intent is to lay this over for possible inclusion. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think House File 174, you did a good job with the timing after the presentation in the Department of Revenue. This is the first time I haven't served on state government finance. I did serve on it for my previous three terms, and I had a lot of the questions that some of you brought up today, and I just kind of smiled to myself thinking these are a lot of the questions that I've had going forward. I think the year I was elected in 2004, I think we had around 700 auditors, and I remember the first time I got a sheet that said how much we had in under-collected taxes, and it was maybe 700 or 800 million, and I couldn't believe that could be. How could we you know, how could we have such a huge amount of underdeveloped collected taxes? And so my first reaction was, well, we need to get more auditors. We need to be able to really zero in on that. Obviously, we're short in that department. We need to, you know, keep putting in more. And we've done that, and I think now we've got over 1,000. We've put in, you know, 300 plus, almost 400 since that time when I first remember thinking that. And we have gotten, Representative Kahn is right, we have gotten increased returns every year, but the one thing I have noticed is it seems like the way they are able to go about getting those returns has been, you know, and it's been diminishing returns, not quite as easy to get that money. And I also worry about probably some of the things that you all worry about is who are they going after? What tools are they using to be able to know who to audit? I've gotten calls, as maybe some of you have other than Representative Gaithier, from businesses feeling like they're being harassed or whatnot because of audits.
Yeah.
And I think that's a concern that many of them have. And so I've been trying to think of ways to be able to get at that under-collected amount of money that we have in taxes, but without going after people who are proper tax-paying citizens. So what House File 174 does is it would have the Department of Revenue issue an RFP for a contract to implement a system of tax analytics and business intelligence tools that would enhance our tax collection. And it would use the auditors that we currently have, and it would just allow them to have the hardware and software and analytics tools available so that they can use that data in a really smart way, and they would be able to identify strong audit candidates. I noticed in the governor's budget he's wanting to hire an additional 81 auditors, and I would suggest to you that there are other states that have used business intelligence tools, whereas we could make a lot of that additional revenue without having to continue to hire additional auditors. And I think that's about all I'll say for now. I do have someone here that's going to testify as to how this can work. Obviously, there are several vendors that could go after this RFP, but I have one here who can kind of talk to a little bit about how this actually works, and then be happy to take questions after that. And this is John DeLacy from SAS.
Thank you, Chair.
And please identify yourself for the record.
Certainly. I'm John DeLacy with SAS Institute. I'm the government account executive that focuses solely on the state of Minnesota and also the state of Wisconsin. So that's my role. I'm based in Minneapolis and am here to support an understanding of what is available in the industry, what are best practices for this. There are a set of vendors that provide these kinds of services, so we're here to represent kind of from an industry's perspective what are the capabilities. I think a slide deck has been provided to folks, and I'll give you just a real quick snapshot of SAS, and then we'll move into the content here. Basically, SAS is, you know, the world's leader in business analytics software and applications. That's all we do. 100% of our business is in this space, applying analytic technology software to solve these classes of problems. We make a tremendous investment in research and development, twice of the industry average. We're a $2.4 billion company, have been growing every year, which is really the vote of the customers saying, does this matter to you? Our customers kind of run the gamut. Our largest two market segments is finance is the largest one, and a lot of the innovation in this kind of technology has come from collaborations with the finance industry, who really is driving how do we maximize collections for their business and maximize compliance and collection processes. The state of Minnesota has been a customer for 25 years and used in 10 different departments for different kinds of applications. Currently, I'm not aware of any of the departments that are using us for compliance and collections, but it's a large area of use across the country, and specifically in revenue agencies, there's a list including the IRS, as well as many states use us, and we'll talk about an example of one of those later in the presentation. The general problem, and we heard some of the testimony earlier, revenue departments kind of across the country are collecting 83 to 90% of the tax revenues that are due. The balance is the tax gap, and there's was discussion earlier in the session about what the specifics are for the state of Minnesota. Those are typical and actually maybe above trend in terms of the Department of Revenue is doing probably a better job than other departments in other states. But it still represents hundreds of millions of dollars, and I think in one of the documents that was discussed on page 25, there's some of the estimated annual tax gap for the state of Minnesota. This can be, you know, the largest source is underreporting, and according to industry statistics, 5 to 10% of all returns contain some form of underreporting, but there are other forms of uncollected taxes. So to the goal here, and I've extracted some of the stuff that I've heard from a previous testimony here a couple of weeks ago, obviously the Department of Revenue's goal is to maximize and ensure everyone pays the right amount, no more, no less. Our goal here around this industry best practice is supporting the Department of Revenue with the most powerful software tools, techniques, and analytic capabilities to maximize the tax collection and minimize any of the disruption to businesses or individuals who aren't or shouldn't be audited or reviewed. So it actually helps you with both sides of the targeting activities, and we'll talk more about that. I extracted some of the challenges here around the previous compliance activities. I think that's already been covered. The next slide is the table that around the state of Minnesota's specific tax compliance initiatives. And what was striking from the testimony a couple of weeks ago was the level of results that you've attained in terms of the focus and activities, you know, over the period from 2002 to present, but also it is reflective of using the same approaches are getting diminishing returns. So the return on investment started at the 10-to-1 sort of relationships, moved to the 4-to-1, and that is also approximately the scoring for the governor's proposal of adding additional people. Our goal with using this kind of approach is to start moving back up the curve in terms of return on investment, leveraging and maximizing the investment you're making in the people and resources. The next slide is the slide from the presentation of a couple weeks ago that shows the growth of the compliance staff. And if at that time, they were indicating 1,070 employees that are in the compliance staff. So the focus is how do we make those people more efficient and effective, both in terms of collecting more revenue, but also doing less audits to people that are not folks that or companies that owe additional tax obligations. So it's the focusing effort in working smarter rather than harder. The next slide is a quick one here around, you know, the SAS fraud framework. And probably the takeaway there is this is not a unique problem to Department of Revenue. How do we maximize the compliance and collection activities, and it applies to all of the other programs across state government from audit, fraud, compliance perspective, whether it be the social programs, the Medicaid programs, workers' comp, unemployment insurance. We basically take the same technology solution, but the models are different. How do we model the behaviors? And that's a collaboration we do with the states themselves. So this cuts across all of those. We're going to focus on tax evasion solely here, obviously, for this bill. The next slide, fighting fraud, waste, and abuse, is really about what are some of the fighting fraud, waste, and abuse is really about what are some of the latest approaches in the industry that are helping organizations become more effective. And there's some, I'll go through them real quickly. I'm not going to get into the detailed technology here. But what has happened is the traditional approach has been using business rules. We've seen these kinds of behaviors, so we write a rule in a system to try to find and detect those problems. It's a very reactive approach, but it used to be the leading technology approach for doing that. What's happened over the last number of years is there are additional techniques that have been developed to augment, not replace, the rule systems that organizations use. And they involve things called clustering. That's looking for a cluster of taxpayers that have sort of similar behavior, and you find underpayment, underreporting, or fraudulent behaviors. You look at that cluster of groups that a business rule wouldn't be able to help you determine. There's other pattern detection things that we can also use to discover those kinds of behaviors. There's anomaly detection, so it's looking at the opposite of the cluster, looking for the outliers, and having software that can do that rather than people trying to wade through 3+ million kinds of taxpayers. And there's predictive models that say these are the kinds of behaviors that lead to an ancillary sort of fraud, and it may come from different systems and abilities to analyze the data. And one of the latest things is called link analysis, and basically what it is typically we're finding if someone is underpaying, they may be working with other organizations, groups that are also underpaying. Classic cases in the construction industry, where we may have an organization that's reporting a tax level, an income tax for the business at a certain level, but they may be reporting a higher level of unemployment tax or workers' comp, or maybe even permits for equipment. They may have, you know, $12 million of equipment. And this happened actually in Louisiana, at about $12 million worth of capital equipment, and reporting a $200,000 a year income. Well, this organization was underreporting their sales, their income tax, their sales tax, their workers' comp, unemployment insurance. All of those were collusive, and when the additional information around permitting or equipment information was brought to bear, they were able to discover a $2 million tax underpayment. So the ability to put software in place that takes the information from a wide range of things and can analyze every single return very rapidly with these more advanced models helps with the efficiency as well as the accuracy. So the next slide talks some about that, about what rule systems can provide, and that it doesn't provide a very effective way of selecting the tax returns. And that's one of the keys here, is this kind of technology can provide the capability for you literally with the software to score every tax return that's been submitted, whether it be individual, corporate, sales, all the different kinds of taxes, and determine which are the most likely to be on a non-compliant, under-reporting, or outright fraud, which ones also are likely to generate the greatest return. If you have a small tax issue, it may not be what you want to target. You want to prioritize them based on the amount of potential return, and you may want to target them from other perspectives. Maybe they're historical, maybe they've been audited before and were in compliance or out of compliance. So it gives you the ability and capacity to look at it from a much more comprehensive perspective, every taxpayer, and then give a prioritized list to literally every single compliance person that they come in the morning of their workday, and they've got a prioritized list by the score and the reasons why they were scored higher. So they become much more efficient and effective at targeting those where there's a much greater chance of return. It also helps eliminate some of the issues that we've heard discussioning around here of people that are being audited or companies that are not likely to be out of compliance. So it helps both ends, from the citizen company perspective, not being audited when they shouldn't be, and it helps substantially improve the accuracy of the audits. And I think the third bullet there talks about the audit improvement success rates moving up 20 to 50%. Again, this is about leveraging the 1,071 current people. If you choose to add more people, it would be leveraging those people as well. it also helps because you're taking some of the knowledge of the experts, putting it into software. It doesn't take as much knowledge and experience and training for the new people coming on board, because they now have a prioritized list, you know, every day for them to work on. One of the it provides better ranking, better ordering, that solves some of the unproductive audits, the higher collections, and the return on investment you're currently making, and can really go after targeting that full tax gap. Never going to solve that whole problem, but it can help make a dent on that as an approach. So if we move forward a couple ones, the goal here, too, is to take that kind of knowledge that can be extracted from your existing systems and bring it to bear for the betterment of the tax collection, as well as the reduction of the amount of time and effort that taxpayers have to provide in support of the auditing process. If you move forward to all the data will come from existing systems. To position this doesn't eliminate any of your existing systems, and in fact the work you're doing at Gentax is fantastic in terms of supporting this kind of effort. The organizing, the cleaning, the collection, the elimination of all these other systems will be very, very useful and powerful for supporting that. And in fact, as of today, you have most of your taxes, as was testified earlier. The final rollout will be done, you know, in an approximate year for some of the smaller taxes. You basically have the data in place today to go after most of the taxes in a very organized way. This software sits on top of that. It uses the information you have today. It doesn't require a big investment in new transactional systems. And in fact, from our perspective, we have a program called, it's 100 working days to results, to actual, quantifiable, significant return on investments. So this also can be a very rapid sort of program to start bringing value and leveraging the investment you're making in your current people. Now, I also support Wisconsin. They use the Gentax system as well. They implemented a few years before Minnesota here. They've integrated the SAS software into the Gentax system. And actually, over about half of their data comes from the Gentax system. Now, there'll still be data from other systems that you currently use, or external data like IRS data and so forth that you'll integrate into it, that are used, again, to try to catch the more obscure kinds of people committing fraud or underreporting and so forth. But it's a tremendous start forward and highly leverageable about the investment you made already. So I've talked a little bit about what is it. It's basically a set of analytic models. We've got 200 people in our advanced analytic lab, and we've actually are adding another 100 solely focused on government. Other vendors can provide this kind of service too. It helps you score every return and prioritize those, and provides that kind of prioritized list to your people that are providing compliance and audit. And it helps you determine the most likely candidates for review. It identifies the reasons so people can understand the rationale, and ranks them based on your own priorities here, whether it be revenue collection, compliance. It may also be around, you know, this. We may have a program around going after a class. You know, maybe it's going to be the sales tax area in a particular industry that's that higher underreporting. So you can target it very, very specifically. And it's comprehensive. It can very fast run through your entire tax environment. And it can look at thousands of variables at the same time for every single tax payer. So it gives you the capacity that you wouldn't be able to do with traditional systems. I'll spend just a couple of minutes and then open it to any questions I might have for myself. I met with the state of Wisconsin Department of Revenues about 2 weeks ago, actually after the testimony here, and talked about their success using the SAS software on top of the Gentax system. And this is also, this is publicly available information. We'll have there's a link to the website in the next page. But their objective was to improve audit collection capabilities and integrate them with taxpayer education programs to increase compliance. Part of this targeting, too, doesn't necessarily mean everyone gets audited who gets this score. There's a whole different level of different kinds of responses you might have, starting with sending them a letter, a notice, a phone call. That can be scored in the system, too, as to what the most appropriate response model at this stage, and then depending upon their behaviors, that can change as well. So this would integrate into your existing systems that do that kind of work. So it's an intelligent way to drive compliance. It's an intelligent way to support the audit, and that was what the state of Wisconsin was looking to do. They've implemented this a few years ago as well. They were looking to get the single view of the taxpayer and improve efficiency, many of the same issues we've been hearing here. In their first year of use, they were able to pull forward $32 million in revenue much more quickly than they would have otherwise, and they literally found $5 million in their first year of tax savings. They improved their efficiency dramatically, saving a large number of staff hours. And now it's in use by many hundreds of people in the Department of Revenue in the state of Wisconsin. There is stories and videos available at that website if one wanted to take a look further at their story. So we're back to the goal here is the ability, using the latest technologies in the industry, to provide a much more powerful tool and a way to leverage your current staff and make them more productive, efficient, and minimize the cost and consequences to the public for those audits that probably weren't the best audits to be targeting, in supporting the Department of Revenue's vision of everyone pays the right amount, no more, no less. So that'll conclude my remarks, and I'll open it to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Is it Dolezy?
It's Dolezy.
Dolezy.
Yeah.
What is the cost of this system, typically?
I think the typical cost, and it depends how aggressive we want to get, but typically it's probably something over a biennial period of, you know, $3 to $5 million, something of that range. And I think in the construction of the bill that's been put forth, there was a provision around the vendor providing their costs and recovery through the savings as a funding mechanism.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we know, with the roughly 11% estimated annual tax gap, what amount of that is due to fraud and what amount is just due to not knowing how to comply? That would be my first question.
I'm not here representing myself as an expert in Minnesota, but from an industry's perspective, I think that becomes a pretty great continuum as to what's classified fraud, what's classified noncompliance, what's classified as education. The response to this and how do we maximize the collection process is looking at that whole tax gap. How do we understand it? And then how do we build a response model based on our complex analysis of it for each individual taxpayer? So again, it may be education. So maybe there is a set of information that could be sent out and make them aware. Maybe it's an awareness issue. All the way to the other end of we're seeing collusive fraud rings that are collection of companies that collaborate around these kinds of underpayment, underreporting, the underground economy and so forth. So it's that whole continuum. I haven't seen a good comprehensive analysis from an industry's perspective that broke it into these different buckets.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author, to Representative Pepin, is there a Senate author to this bill?
Representative Pepin?
There is a Senate author. I've got several of these types of bills, and I'm not exactly sure who the Senate author is, but there is a Senate author.
That was one question. Is and I see the fiscal note, so it's neutral. So we just heard it costs $3 to $5 million. Then the fiscal note's neutral. Is that based on the savings sort of scheme that he offered, that the testifier offered?
Well, that might be a better
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Slawick. Well, that might be a better question for staff, but I would, the cost, I think a way to look at that, too, is, and I'm not sure how SAS would necessarily do it, but I think that there are certainly vendors that would do this on a contingency fee. So that would be, they would collect based on what they were able to recover. So I don't know that there's necessarily an upfront cost. Now, I think there'll be a huge savings because of the amount of money you're going to collect, but I don't have those exact numbers. We can only look at what other states have done. And but as far as explaining the fiscal note, maybe Ms. Roberts could address that better.
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, the Department of Revenue did do a fiscal note on this bill, and what they said was that they're unable to determine the administrative costs that would be incurred as a result of entering into the contract until they would be in a position to be able to evaluate the responses to any RFP that went out. So I think they're just, the department is not saying that there wouldn't be costs, but that at this point they're not able to evaluate what those costs would be.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick.
It's hard as we go into our almost our final budgets here in the next 3 weeks, and where we can't determine different costs and then determine how things are going to come out in the budget. Is Representative Pepin, does the Department of Revenue have a position on this bill? Have you talked with them, met with them about whether this is duplicating work that they're already doing?
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick. I haven't this year. I have spoken with them. Commissioner Ines a lot over past years, and I know that one of their concerns in the past was making sure they were completed with the tax integration system, and they wanted to, you know, they were a little reticent. They did feel at that time that they wanted to go in this direction. I haven't spoken to the new commissioner about it, so if they wanted to testify, that would be fine.
Mr. Chair, just at some point, we'd like to know that. I mean, it'd be interesting to know their position, just because we've had a change in administrations, and also seeing how it integrates, and in effect you're hiring an outside organization to come in and do the work when we already have we have the department in place to do the work.
And Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, I don't believe that this is duplicative. I think this is, as Mr. DeLacy said, it's additional tools on top of what they already have. Thank you.
Representative Leidinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, on the install basis, my question is also about the costs of this program, but I'm in your install basis, what are the operating costs, the long-term operating costs? Are most of your licenses, are they... Do they have a fixed cost to it? Is it something that's linked to the performance of the software system? Can you speak to that a bit, please?
Mr. Dolezy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the predominant cost is during the initial term of building the system and establishing it and working with the department around extracting what are the priorities that get represented into the software. I'm speaking from SAS perspective. There are a number of other vendors out there. The ongoing costs are much less than that, and typically the ongoing costs are staff in the Department of Revenue. It's not staff from SAS. We're not looking to have people embedded into the state. This is something we build and train and work with your folks to implement on a long-term basis. So that implementation, the first 100 days we can get to value, it might be a full year to add in other capabilities, and then over time the state can be adding those in. From a contract perspective that was brought up, the construction of the contract, the terms and conditions, the gain share kind of model and so forth would be the Department of Revenue's job to figure out. You know, I think it's in the bill itself. It's framed, but it's silent in terms of the details. And there's a wide diversity of those kinds of contracts, and those are fairly new in this kind of a practice, but are becoming more commonly explored, especially with the deficits that we're at, sort of shifting the cost to the vendor. And those typically have a multi-year kind of return model, and at some point it gets transitioned to where all the gains and benefits would be the state's.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman and members and Representative Pepin, several points. For one thing, this was included in last year's omnibus bill from this division and was turned down by the Senate. One of the issues that's come up, and this is the issue of duplication and so forth, is the department, the work that the department has done with the University of Minnesota students for free on data mining techniques with the assistance of the University of Minnesota. What's, you know, how does that effort fit in with this? Because the department has, one of the things is that the department has redesigned and migrated all of its legacy warehouse data to a common database platform, adding 17 new data sources and piloted the use of data mining techniques with the university, assistance of the University of Minnesota. I guess maybe that's something for the department to answer on this issue. And then, 2 points about supporting this. One of the changes that we made before we put it in the bill last time, on line 2.3, was that we modified responses with the word reasonable, because it's not clear. Suppose that all the responses are incredibly expensive, or some of them are clearly from fraudulent companies and so forth. You know, this language looks as if you'd have to choose one anyway. So, if you wouldn't object, I'd like to move to add the word reasonable on before responses on page 2.3.
Representative Pepin, your feelings about that?
I don't have a problem with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Representative Kahn, would you clarify your motion then?
It's to add on page 2.3, line 2.3, before responses, add the word reasonable.
Okay, Representative Kahn has moved to add that word reasonable on line 2.3 after based on, insert the word reasonable. Discussion? Representative Pepin has agreed to that. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The bill is amended.
Now, a further problem, and this has to do with the decisions, you know, that were in the bill that we've already passed through your committee and is coming here, that, you know, I guess I'd surely like to see part of OET figure into this decision, and maybe it will all be fixed by Representative Downey's bill. But, just concerned that this database is a real that we maybe be turning over to a private entity or allowing access to a private entity is, I think, one of the most important protected databases in the state. And so that's an issue that I'm a little concerned about how that would be handled. And then another thing, I don't know how many of the people here went to the One Minnesota conference that we had, but one of the models that was given was the Helsinki model, but just putting this out as a proposal and having somebody do it totally free of cost and just as a demonstration. You know, I guess there are a lot of other states doing it, but, you know, that language may be covered in where the vendor shares the risk of the project's success. But the idea that one of the things we'd analyze, and I don't have language right now to do it, that we'd analyze the proposals on is how little effort they require of the state and how much they require of everybody else with some sharing of the proceeds. I don't. As I said, that the language might be covered from 2.4 to 2.6, but since we're not passing it on today, we have time. But I'd like us to think about that.
Representative Pepin, any comment?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I think that makes a lot of sense, and I know Representative Kahn has looked at this a lot in the past and offers a lot of good suggestions, so I certainly wouldn't be opposed to if there's language that would improve it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I don't completely remember, but I have the Senate had a fanatic approach to not having any policy language in the bill, regardless of it. Said that it had to absolutely be budget-related. Now, I don't see how collecting money is not budget-related, but I think it was a fight that we, Senate, always proved to be more stubborn than me. But with a new chair, maybe we'll change that dynamic.
Representative Kahn, I'm with you.
That means you're going to cave in. I'm telling you to be. I'm telling you to
I
be.
I would not interpret it that way. I've already had some interesting discussions with my Senate counterpart about some issues. So, members, we have at least one person who wants to testify. And since we're coming up to 10 o'clock, I want to give Mr. Neumeister an opportunity to come forward and speak to this bill. And obviously, we're not going to, we are going to lay this bill over, and we need some further discussion along the way. But Mr. Neumeister, would you care to speak to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. And for those people that do not know me and that are new to the legislative process, I've been like a doorknob up here for decades, and I testify and I lobby on privacy, civil liberties, and openness in government. Now, Representative Anderson used an interesting word when talking about compliance, hunting. But House File 174, I think, is a good bill, but you got to look in the details. What it is, it wants to do tax compliance and using technology. Of how to look at tax compliance historically has been the tip. Or the observation that someone might run, you know, the paper clipping. Oh, Rich Neumeister won $100,000. And so you do those kinds of things. But with technology, it has an impact, and it has an impact on our lives. For me, and particularly with the new legislature that has arrived here on January 4th, there is a more heightened respect about government doing scrutiny of individuals. This has always been, but parties sometimes change emphasis. And number two, there's a little bit more understanding, at least on some issues, of the individual. And that's one of the things that I have some concerns about this bill. Now, if you take a look at the language on page one, you talk about means of identifying candidates. What are those? What are the existing databases? What are the other available databases? What's happening a lot is there's a lot of private entities out there that want to sell databases. It's done in a lot of law enforcement, but to be done by revenue department or whatever. How does the individual get involved in this? One of the things that as this bill goes forward, and I have to thank Representative Pepin for doing this, because technology can be a friend to the state or for the individual or the agency, but they must control it, not the technology itself. So what are the best ways to achieve the goal of tax compliance? I think one of the things that has to be done is to get an idea who the candidates are. Number two, there has to be straight accountability and transparency of what the techniques are going to be. I also think that it's important to have some type of reporting mechanism done to you all, maybe on an annual basis or whatever, when this starts to happen. The bottom line here is that this involves individual rights, privacy rights, and whether or not you want to call it hunting, profiling, trolling, that's what it is. In a positive way, but it can be in a negative way. You're trying to get people that are cheating the state that should be paying appropriate taxes. I agree with that, and everyone else on this committee, I believe, agrees with that. But the bottom line, it has to be done fairly and properly and with concepts that historically Minnesota has always been good in mind, respecting the individual, their privacy rights, and accountability and transparency. So, Mr. Chairman, I was going to go in a little bit more detail, but with the few moments I had, at least I just wanted to get out the major points that when you review this legislation again, you've got to look at some of the details that focus on some of the principles that I enunciated.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And is there anyone else who came today to be able to testify to this bill?
Yeah.
members, we are going to leave this bill over. If members feel we need to have Representative Pepin come back for further discussion, I'm sure she would be willing to do that. Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding that, have we set the deadlines yet, or do we know in HHS we learned that the HHS bill is coming out 2 weeks from yesterday? Have you set when our bill is coming out?
Well, we have to, Representative Slavik, we have to pass our bill out by the 25th of March, which means that earlier that week our bill will have to be out and ready for discussion.
Is there, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is there a date where you'll be presenting your bill?
Well, it'll be early that week.
Early that week, okay. Leaving some flexibility,
yep.
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. We want to make sure we have adequate time.
Yes.
I don't like bills that come out right before you're having to pass on it. So we're going to try to have the bill out early in that week.
Okay. Thank you.
We are adjourned.